Welcome to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Hello, I'm Charlotte Metcalfe, and today I'm delighted to be in conversation with the eminent historian and biographer Anne Seber, whose books, particularly about well-known and often misunderstood women like Ethel Rosenberg and Wallis Simpson, have been published to wide acclaim. She's also a popular lecturer and makes regular appearances on television and radio. Her latest book, published last year on the 80th anniversary of the liberation of Belsenbergen, is The Women's Orchestra of Auschwitz, A Story of Survival. I'm particularly excited to be talking to Anne about this book, as regular oldie readers will know that Anita Lasker Wolfish, aged 100, was pronounced maestra at this year's Oldie of the Year Awards. Anita was one of the cellists who played in the Auschwitz Orchestra and managed to survive the camp's unimaginable horrors, which the book describes in harrowing but gripping detail. Anne Seber, a very warm welcome to Radio Oldie.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure to talk about this story.
Now, what I thought was really interesting about this book is your initial absolute fascination with how they survived. So tell me a bit about that. Is that what first got you really interested? How on earth did anyone survive that?
Well, that is what got me interested as I wrote it. I didn't want to write simply, in inverted commas, simply a story of how terrible Auschwitz was. I rather assumed that we all know that the Nazis were evil and that there was torture and cruelty and bestiality, and I don't ignore it, but I actually was fascinated by why would you want to survive when you've seen the worst that humanity has to offer? You may have arrived on the ramp, deported with your family, you've seen your mother, your aunt, taken straight to be gassed, maybe a younger brother. All of those things happened to the girls and women in the orchestra, but really they were girls, most of them. And I thought many of them must surely have wanted to end their lives, but they didn't. They absolutely decided that life was worth living. And I find that intriguing. So I hope that ultimately people who read my book come away with a sense of, my goodness, life is beautiful. It has terrible aspects. We've lived through one of the worst centuries imaginable when we were meant to be progressing. But hey, we can do something about it. We can stand up and be counted and somehow embrace life.
I think it's really interesting what you're saying about why would you want to survive? Because what you were very good at, and well, describing the horror of just how many people, when they started bringing the Hungarians in particularly, just there was one day, I think, where 2,500 people were just processed and sent off to the gas chambers, and there the orchestra was playing, and it was so commonplace to die. It was just, it was more normal to die than to survive.
Couldn't expect to survive if you were old, by which I mean anything over 40, or young, or just the flick of a finger that they didn't like the look of you, you'd be sent to be gassed. But there were a number of other squads, as the Nazis called them, or commandos, that you could be brought into the camp and work. So there was the kitchen, the laundry, the office, and then later on, the orchestra. And all of those offered a chance of life. It wasn't guaranteed. But the worst commandos were if you were being sent out to work in the fields, because they were constantly enlarging Auschwitz. So there was dredging fields, there was the wrecking commando, and then there were sub-factories. So that actually, as we've delved into this, is the purpose of the orchestra. It was really a marching band. Well, there were two purposes. One was to tell a lie, to give the impression that this was a military camp with discipline. The other purpose was to play tunes so that the women going out to work in the worst of all commandos had to march in time. Mm. And it was easier for the Nazis to count them, 5, 10, 15, 20. And, you know, they had this mania for numbers. God knows why they cared, since, as you say, they were trying to kill as many of them as they could. And really, those were so cruel and so devastating, merely having to do this brutal work. And then to hear the orchestra playing them out and playing them in. So that's another theme of my book, how the other members of the camp viewed the orchestra. Mm. And, of course, they were despised.
Yeah,
they felt that they were an extra additional instrument of their torture. But what could they do? And my view is that far from collaborating, which some people accuse them of, because they, of course, did the Nazi bidding, they did the reverse of collaborating. They survived.
Yes.
And survival is the number one form of resistance, given that the Nazis wanted to exterminate the entire Jewish race. So they've survived. And, well, you mentioned Anita at the top of the piece.
Mm.
Anita, because she's alive, was one of two women that I had the good fortune to interview. And the most telling remark that she says is, whatever else the Nazis did, they could not kill music. Music is music. And she's a brilliant living example of that, because she's created a musical dynasty. Her son is the famous cellist Raphael Valfisch. Her two grandsons, Simon and Benjamin, are terribly well-known musicians. One's a composer in Hollywood and the other is a baritone. So in her case, she has absolutely proved the Nazis wrong.
But how did you start with this book? Because what a huge undertaking to track them all down.
I'll tell you how I started and then we'll talk about the particular members of the orchestra.
Yes.
Because actually, when Alma Rosé was in charge,
yes,
the numbers rose to possibly 45 or 46.
She was trying to save everybody.
She did save them.
Yeah.
Nobody under her baton went to the gas chambers.
Yeah.
If they were slightly ill and went to the infirmary, she insisted that they were treated with whatever rudimentary medicine there was, because she would argue to the Nazis, what's the point of my training them if you then let them die? None of them died when she was in charge. Now, I was vaguely aware of this story, but there was a particular moment when it started. I'd actually been researching a story that probably would have happened in Belsen, Bergen-Belsen, because Belsen was the camp that the British liberated on April the 15th, 1945. And I think it's one of the real triumphs of the British Army, and it's barely recognised. If you ask a lot of people, you know, what do you know about the British Army in World War II? They'll probably say Dunkirk. And Dunkirk was actually a terrible failure, which Churchill cleverly dressed up as a success with all these small ships. I'm not undermining Dunkirk. But taking us back to Belsen, when the British Army marched in and they were faced with these 60,000 skeletal bodies, piles of dead bodies, they had no idea that they would face this impossible task of bringing order and control. How many Nazis could they actually take prisoner to help clear the bodies? How many could they allow to flee, because they couldn't take them all prisoner? It required medical understanding, discipline. They didn't have nearly enough troops to deal with it all. And when Richard Dimbleby made his famous broadcast, the BBC refused to broadcast it.
It was too harrowing.
They said nobody will believe it, and he threatened to resign.
I don't think he believed what he was saying.
How could you?
How could you? No.
I mean, I've got the notes from doctors. Nothing had prepared them for this.
No.
They didn't know what to feed these starving bodies, and yet they brought it all under control. So I was researching to see what sort of story would I find in Belsen, when my wonderful son said to me, but Mum, why do you always research other people? You know your own father. My grandfather was in Belsen. My father was a British tank driver. And whenever I tried to talk to him about it, he always said, oh, but I wasn't there at the liberation. You know, let's leave it. Like so many of that generation.
Yes.
Wouldn't talk about it.
No, indeed.
When I finally went to the National Archives at Kew, and shame on me, they're 5 minutes away from where I live, I found his own file. It was in his handwriting. He was in charge of, first of all, bringing order to the place, locking up the strong room so that the papers couldn't be destroyed, as the Nazis had tried to do in Auschwitz.
Eliminate all traces, didn't
and,
they? They tried to rip down the crematoria and everything.
So the story was that at the end of the war, the Nazis had separated this orchestra, which was half Jewish, half Christian, and sent the Jewish members to Belsen. So there was half of the orchestra sitting in Belsen, trying not to fall ill with dysentery and all the other terrible illnesses and malnutrition. And on May the 24th, 1945, the Red Cross, who moved in, organised a concert for some of these people to play in, mostly singers, and this was a Red Cross concert to entertain the troops. When I looked at my father's notes, on that same day, May the 24th, in his handwriting, he was organising the destruction of the lice-ridden huts in Belton, trying to bring order. And once I discovered that these were on the same dates, the symmetry of these dates, I knew I had to write about it. Now, there's a bit of a backstory, because I do feel that people who write about the Holocaust exploit it. Many people write novels about the Holocaust. And I felt, I'm not a survivor, I'm not the child of survivors, what right do I have? This, if you like, gave me permission to write about it. I'll never know. My father died 30 years ago, but I'm convinced. Where else would he have gone that night? He must have crossed paths. He probably went to that concert. Gosh, so that was actually what got me into the story. And I did have the good fortune to meet two people who were part of, who actually played in the orchestra, Anita and her very close friend Hilda, who was also 99, who everybody thought had died when I started this book. Wikipedia said there's only one living member. But actually, I discovered there was this other one. So when people are 99, you don't mess about. I flew to Israel straight away, and I met not only Hilda, who was amazing. She lived to 100, but I'm so thrilled I caught her and heard what she had to say. But I also met the grandchildren of other members who were all living on this kibbutz in Israel. So
on the same kibbutz?
Yes.
That's so interesting.
It was called Kibbutz Buchenwald, and it was set up deliberately for people who had nowhere else to go.
That's right, you do talk about that.
It's now changed its name. Yeah. But yes, wasn't it interesting? Mm. Because, of course, one of the other women on the kibbutz, Regina, who wasn't alive anymore, had been saved by Hilda, but she felt she wasn't good enough to play in the orchestra, and she never forgave Hilda for saving her. That's survivor's guilt. She felt she had no right to survive. So I learnt all about these complications of the post-war life. I mean, the war did not end in 1945. But what really, really aided my research is Steven Spielberg. I say my prayers every night to Steven Spielberg, because after he made all his money in Schindler's List, he set up the Shoah Foundation. And to see these women on tape beamed into my study was really extraordinary. There is no shortage of material. And that was really the basis of my research. And these women, as they talk about their experiences and they talk about the humiliation of being stripped, the tattoo was painful, but that wasn't the big thing. The big thing was having their hair shaved.
The hair, yes, the hair.
They all break down. They could be 70, 80. Mm. They still can't talk about having their hair shaved without crying. But what I realised when I finished, because Holocaust scholars, and I'm not one of those, wrote to me and said, thank you for doing this, because many of the Holocaust stories are really about men. Women haven't told their stories.
So true.
For whatever reason, either they've got on with their lives or had children, but actually it's a different story to tell. Now, I'm not saying it's worse. Of course, there's no hierarchy of suffering, but it is different. For a man to be shaved, it's not so humiliating. No. So, I mean, I just feel, and I keep on saying it, but it is such a privilege to tell these stories, because every time I think, what would I have done?
I wouldn't have survived for 5 minutes.
There is no answer to that, of course, but you can't help thinking about it.
So can we just talk for a minute about that? Because there were two particular camp monsters. Maria Mandel was one. I mean, there was obviously Kramer, who's got that wonderful title, the Hauptsturmführer.
Yes.
He was.
These titles are extraordinary. They try and make them sound military. But often they had no military experience at all.
They were just bully.
Cruel people. I mean, Nazis made up half these titles. But I think you're right to pitch the female guards against the male guards, because the women could never be members of the SS. They never reached the same high levels. They didn't get the same rank, and they didn't get the same pay. So there was jockeying for position among all the female guards. That's one thing. How does a female guard establish herself and get noticed? Well, partly by being more cruel, more abusive, more bullying. Maria Mandel was very good at that. But I think her story is interesting. Why did she join the camps in the first place in the early 30s? Well, because she joined the government post office and she was thrown out of work. This is a time of depression. Mm-hmm. So joining the growing camp system was a way to be in a job with respect, with uniform. The perks were amazing. You know, they had all these wonderful clothes that the Jewish women brought. They had time off. They went to these country sort of saunas and spas in between. It was a very sought-after job. They still didn't have the same hierarchy, the same rank as the men. So they were constantly trying to make themselves known and reach higher levels. And Maria Mandel was having an affair with a Nazi architect who was university educated and definitely several notches of superiority above her. So in order to impress him with how cultured she was, she thought, oh, I'll set up an orchestra. This is the only entirely female orchestra in any of the camps or prisons or ghettos in Nazi Germany. There were several male orchestras in Auschwitz alone, a symphony orchestra, a jazz orchestra, chamber orchestra, but the men had to go out to work in between and then play in the morning and the evening. So Mandel realised that to have a successful women's orchestra, she would have to allow them to rehearse in the middle. And she did. She was so keen to make this project hugely successful. It was an entirely selfish power project, really born out of lust, because she thought it would make her look more educated, more cultured in the eyes of this Nazi architect. And that's why when she discovered Alma Rose in the camp, Alma Rose, who was the niece of Gustav Mahler, a Viennese musical royalty, she suddenly thought this was the answer to her prayers, and she spared her life on condition that she organised this extremely talented and effective orchestra of excellence. But her motives were base. Once the Nazis realised they had Alma Rose, they were so proud of having this very talented musician from the heart of Viennese musical royalty that they asked her to give, in addition to the marching hours in the morning and in the evening, a 3-hour concert on a Sunday. So, you know, you have to understand that the Nazis are exhausted from all their week of killing and gassing. Mm. On a Sunday, they need a bit of time off to unwind and calm down. And Alma gave them that. She gave them these 3-hour concerts, and she knew how they adored opera. So that enabled her to rescue singers. Now, the singers had a double purpose. In the first place, they were often musically trained so they could arrange pieces and orchestrate, because it was a very odd orchestra, you know, 3 mandolins, 1 guitar, 2 accordionists, several flutes, only 1 bass instrument, Anita, who played the cello. There was no bass line, really. So any music they had, and they didn't have much, a lot of it was just written out on the staves from memory on blank paper. So she had to have musically trained people, but they couldn't necessarily play in the orchestra, and that enabled her to save more people. And all of this reflected glory on Mandel. It was only 8.5 months. But during
those...
She
didn't survive, though, did she?
That's the extraordinary thing. She was able to save everyone else, but not herself.
Not herself, no.
Why? Why did she die? I mean, nobody quite has the answer. She died of food poisoning, botulism. I don't think people died accidentally of her stature in Auschwitz. I think she had a lot of jealousy directed.
Yes, they did have quite a few privileges. They got beds, and when you call it Canada, just explain to our listeners what Canada was.
Well, Canada was the warehouse where they could have some sort of a sweater, maybe, not much. I mean, I have real difficulty in talking about this word privileges in a place like Auschwitz. Yeah. Let's discuss what we both mean by privileges, because I do think it's important to get straight. So Mandel and the whole Nazi structure decided they wanted this orchestra to survive. So they were invested in it, if you like. But I don't think they had real privileges in terms of food wasn't better. They had the same freezing cold, the same aching hunger. Clothes, well, they did have a pair of underpants. Now, for my research, I tried to spend a day walking around here without wearing underpants and a bra.
They had no bras ever, did they? No
bras and no underpants. No. And you may think that's a small thing. Well, it is a small thing. It doesn't kill you. Mm. Well, when you've got your period, then suddenly rags become the most expensive currency. You have to pay for rags, and it's rags or bread. Which do you go for when you're starving?
Yeah.
So all those things, but what they did have was access to a toilet. So if they woke in the night and needed to go, they could go. For other prisoners, they just had to sit in their bed. Yeah. And that is enormous, but I think there's something even more important than that. There's dignity. So with their own bed, access to a toilet, underpants, they had dignity. With dignity comes the belief that maybe I'll survive only till tomorrow, one day at a time. Anita says, we did not have the luxury of feelings. We didn't look far ahead. We just thought, if I can live to tomorrow, and tomorrow, and tomorrow, and tomorrow. So that brings us on to what I think is the real privilege, hope. I think if you can live with hope, that is really a key element. But as I say, even the use of the word privilege is so grotesque, really, in Auschwitz.
Yes.
But many of them did survive. And it's extraordinary that any of them did survive, let alone live to 100, which several of them did, actually.
Before we get on to Anita, there's a really interesting period you write about, because you think, oh, when it's liberated, that's going to be the end of the book. Oh, no, because there was such a dreadful long period after the camp was so-called liberated, wasn't it? Because they were all in that no-man's land of...
Oh, in Belsen.
Mm.
Belsen was not closed until 1950. That's why I was attracted to it in the first place.
Yeah.
And so Belsen was not an extermination camp, but you died of malnutrition, disease, proximity. It was built as a German army camp for hundreds... Not these thousands who were there, thousands of starving, desperate people. And, you know, the British not only had to bring it under control and decide who should be charged with war crimes, but get these desperate people back to some sort of home. So the new name arose of displaced person, or DP. Well, for most of them, they couldn't go back. There was no back to go to in Austria, in Eastern Europe or Poland.
No.
Their family had been killed, their homes destroyed, they were hated, there was still anti-Semitism. Where could they go? There were quotas for America, Australia, New Zealand, Britain, everywhere. There were quotas. Where could they go? And even if they were not Zionists and they had not wanted to go to British-mandated Palestine, many of them ultimately felt that was the only place they could go. But there were quotas there.
That was really that was so interesting, how difficult it was to get to Palestine. It was really difficult.
Yes, I mean, the British were worried about the Arabs.
Yeah.
Not worried enough, clearly, as we see today. So it was chaos, really.
Mm.
I don't like to pick any of these women to extrapolate them and say they were different from any of the others, because actually none of them would have survived without the whole team. It was the orchestra. Nonetheless, Hilda Grunbaum was very special. She was something of a leader. She always had been. She looked after her mother when she was offered a place on the Kinder transport in 1939 to come to England. She turned it down. Anyway, when the Nazis decided to separate the orchestra and send the Jewish members to Belsen and try and get rid of everybody in the camp, they said, take your clothes off immediately, get on the train, you're not going back into the music block. Don't disobey orders, just get on the train. And Hilda showed not only extraordinary courage in disobeying Nazi orders, but she did go back into the block. And she took not sensible things like food or a blanket or a jumper. She took three things: her copy of Goethe's Faust, because she always believed German literature was superior. She took Alma's diary, because Alma had died by then. And she took the red bag that she had made to carry the music around in. She kept these artefacts. I mean, amazing historical foresight. She kept them throughout Belsen and donated them to the museum in Israel, Yad Vashem, where they are now. Why? She said, because in years to come, people won't believe that this could possibly have happened, and I need objects that are proof. Oh, also
the pelican
fountain pen.
Yes, tell our listeners about that.
Well, Kramer saw her struggling with
the brutal guard, Kramer. Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
You know, this was hard work. The music commander was not a soft option. I really have to emphasise that. And Hilda got an abscess on her neck, so she couldn't play the violin after a while. And she was terrified she'd be kicked out of the orchestra, but she made herself useful by being one of the copyists and arrangers. And she struggled with writing out these musical staves and the arrangements with a pencil that was getting blunt. And when Kramer saw her struggling, he said, oh, here's a pelican fountain pen. And she kept that fountain pen, and that was another of the things that she's donated to Yad Vashem. So, you know, let those who deny it go and look at these things and try and argue where they came from.
Humble objects. So now let's get on to our oldie maestra, Anita. How often did you meet her? What was she like?
I mean, it really goes back to what I started by saying. If you're not a survivor or the child of survivors, is it your story to tell?
Yeah.
And I felt, the first time I met Anita, why would she want to tell me? I'm a writer, I'm a journalist, I'm an author. She's told her story, there is a memoir, and here am I exploiting her story. So I went really, I like to think quite humbly. I always take people I'm interviewing flowers or chocolates or something. Anyway, I took her a copy of my previous book on Ethel Rosenberg. And she said, I've said it all before, and clearly the world doesn't want to know because anti-Semitism is rife. So I think you're wasting your time, Anne. So every question sort of, we went round in circles, and I thought, well, I've had the good fortune to meet her. She doesn't want to tell me anymore because she said it all before. Fair enough. She telephoned me 48 hours later, and she said, Anne, I owe you an apology because I've read your book on Ethel Rosenberg, and I now realise you're not just, quote unquote, you're not just a journalist, you are a serious author, and if you want to come again, I'm prepared to talk. And I was so profoundly grateful to her. So,
and flattered. I mean, what a wonderful thing to say, yes.
I know. Biographers do have a reputation for being vultures, with good reason, because they exploit their subjects. I try terribly hard not to do that, and particularly with Anita, who had these formative years. Before she arrived at Auschwitz, she spent more than a year in a German prison with her sister Renata. And she's very funny in her memoir. She says that because she then arrived in Auschwitz as a convicted criminal with a file, she had to be processed. She couldn't be sent straight to the gas chambers. And she said it was better to arrive in Auschwitz as a convicted criminal than as a Jew, because as a Jew, you'd be sent straight to be gassed.
What was she in prison for?
Forging papers. After her parents were arrested and deported and killed, she and her sister were alone. And the Nazis decided that children kept alone like that had to be put to work. So she and her sister were sent to a paper factory to work. It was forced labour. And in the paper factory, they tried, as kids might, to forge French identity papers. Well, of course, they were found out and they were sent to prison. But the case was ongoing. And that year and a bit in a German prison was what saved them. Because had they been sent straight to Auschwitz, they'd have been gassed and killed.
What happened to Renata, her sister?
Thanks to Anita's authority in the camp, because, I mean, again, this is such a difficult word to use, authority. How can a Jewish girl have any authority. But she was able to say to Mandel, I'm the cellist, and Mandel wanted the orchestra to survive, so she knew how desperately important having a cellist was. Nita said, I've got a sister who's not a musician. Can you find a job for her in a safe commando? And Mandel gave her a job as a messenger, and that enabled Renata to survive.
And what happened to Renata in the end?
She survived and came to England and France and lived in Europe and became a journalist.
Gosh. And are you still in touch with Anita?
I absolutely am. She's been quite unwell recently and I owe her a visit. She is such a rock, such a real example of what it means to be resilient. I know that's another overused word.
I think
I started by wanting to understand, was it because Anita was so resilient that she survived? Or is it survival that made her resilient? And I still don't really know the answer. But she's an exceptional human being. And here's another reason why she's exceptional. Almost all the women in the orchestra could not listen to music, let alone play music afterwards. And many of them couldn't go to concerts. Their careers were finished. Anita said, as I've quoted, the Nazis can't break music. So she's a founder member of the English Chamber Orchestra. She played the cello, and music has been her life. So in this, as in so much else, she is the exception. She is extraordinary. I mean, it just is such a privilege and an honour to meet people like that who really know what matters in life and are prepared to live by that. There are other Auschwitz survivors alive who remember the orchestra, and they don't remember it with any fondness. Why would they? I find memory. One of the most fascinating things.
Yes.
Because, you know, these women did not have diaries or pencils to write anything down. They didn't have watches or clocks or radios. They didn't know what time of year it was. And yet they all have very strong memories of this time and what it meant to them. I've found in my work generally, actually, that if you get an elderly person, and, you know, you can define elderly however you want, but that period of late teens is often something that stands out, is etched so sharply in their memory. And they would have different memories of this. But for me, that doesn't invalidate it at all. I sometimes remember stories, and I talk to my sister about, do you remember when our parents did X or Y? And she says, no, it wasn't like that at all. You know, we all have different memories.
Indeed.
It's part of being human.
Especially siblings.
Yes.
So let's just go back to you before I let you go. So you started off at Reuters, didn't you, after... Yes.
I always, always wanted to be a war correspondent.
Did you?
I mean, my parents remember buying me a plastic typewriter when I was about 8 or 9.
Goodness.
It just was one of those things. I've been fascinated by history and I wanted to report on wars. So when Reuters took me on, I couldn't believe my good fortune and that I was being paid to do a job I loved. And it really was always that. But
where did they send you?
Well, that's another story. I went there speaking French, German and Russian, and they said, those are all too dangerous for a woman. We're going to send you to Rome. It's better for a woman. And I said, but I don't speak Italian. Never mind. They said, you'll learn. Well, I had a wonderful time in Rome and I loved it. There weren't any wars to cover. So I was the first woman that they took, and then I was the first woman that they sacked when I got pregnant, because you could do that in those days.
Yes.
And they said, you can't be a foreign correspondent and a mother. So I started writing books, and I've had a wonderful life, and I'm totally fine with it, because I really have met so many interesting people. I've curated my own life. But I never was a war correspondent. I've written a book about war correspondents called Battling for News. And I'm drawn to extraordinary scenarios. I just write about war. But actually being a war correspondent, I'm afraid I've failed on
that
front.
Would you like to have been Martha Gellhorn in another life?
I would absolutely, or Christian Amanpour, or any of these, any of these extraordinary.
There's still time. I mean, we're well, back.
All right. Thank you. JB.
Yes. So yes, what next? What is next? I mean, other than rushing off to report on the war that we're about to enter.
Yes. What well, is next? Absolutely. We may all find ourselves citizen war correspondents. Heaven help us. I really don't know. I haven't got a good idea. And I think this book is so hard to follow.
Mm.
I always have this problem, but Ethel Rosenberg was quite dark. She's electrocuted.
Yes.
This is much darker. I can't suddenly write about fashion and shopping.
But please don't.
No, I won't. But on the other hand, you know, I do say a grim book for grim times, and probably it will be about women, but if anyone's got a good idea of some extraordinary woman who needs to be resurrected and seen in a different light, I'm looking is the answer. What book needs writing in a revisionist vein? That's what I like. Well, turning what? Stories on their heads.
Well, you've done this book is absolutely exceptional, and you're off to California tomorrow to talk about it. So good luck there, and thank you so much. What a privilege to talk to you. Thank you very much, Anne Sebba, for being on Radio Oldie with me.
Thank you all for listening.
You've been listening to me, Charlotte Metcalfe, in conversation with the historian and author of The Women's Orchestra of Auschwitz, Anne Sebba. If you've enjoyed listening to our conversation and would like to hear more like this, please go to www.theoldie.co.uk, where you'll also be able to subscribe to the magazine. Meanwhile, many thanks to you again, Anne Sebba, to Bailey Gifford for sponsoring us, and to you for listening. Goodbye. You've been listening to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Why not get 3 trial issues of the Oldie magazine for just £1? I'm sure you'll enjoy it. We'll then charge you £25.75 for every 6 issues. Just go to checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial as one word in capitals. That's checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial.